This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is November 12th, 2009. This is another session with Associate Dean Frank Kustra of the College of Agriculture and Agricultural Life Sciences. Frank, we wanted to begin this session with a review of your work in Africa, how that came about, what you did, and what the conclusion of it was.
Okay. So, this started in 1985. The college won an international project in the Gambia, West Africa. The title of the project was the GARD Project, which was an acronym that stood for the Gambia Agricultural Research and Diversification Project. And the goal of this USAID-funded project was to bring an element of research and development to their agricultural economy. The Gambia is a small country in West Africa, very small.
Where is it?
It's on the west coast, surrounded by the Gambia River. I meant surrounded by Senegal.
Oh, okay.
And the country really surrounds the Gambia River, which is a very large river that penetrates directly east into sort of the bulge of West Africa, about 11 degrees north of the equator. So
okay.
It's just north of the equator. There's a lot of desertification going on in that part of Africa because north of there is the Sahara Desert. And so this is still in an area that is heavily forested, but people in that part of the world need wood for their cooking and burning. So forestry is a very critical issue with preventing the whole dry, arid kind of conditions from moving further south. Anyway, our mission was to go to there and work with their Ministry of Agriculture, the Department of Agricultural Research, to put in place a research and development component to their agricultural ministry.
Frank, had you been involved in the design of the grant application?
No. I was in my role as Associate Dean for Administration. While I was aware of what was going on, I really wasn't party to the writing or anything else. In fact, I had really no aspirations at that point to get into international work. Mm-hmm. The project started in 1985, and we were very excited about it because in our mind, if you're going to develop the kind of human capital and research agendas to increase agricultural productivity, this wasn't a short-term goal. This we expected to be there for 10 to 15, maybe 20 years.
Hmm. Who was the PI on this?
Ken Shapiro, ironically, was the PI.
Oh.
Because we used Cal's faculty and to go into the country and actually serve as long-term technical assistants. And we had a chief of party that went and served sort of the full-time on-site administrative role. So the project started in 1985, and we hired a team to go in there, along with a couple faculty members to look at agronomic and soil science activities. And the most of these assignments are two-year long-term assignments. And there was a review coming up. And I was asked to go on behalf of the college to look at the management of the project. Hmm. We had just encountered some problems. The scientific aspects of the project were quite appropriate for our faculty, but implementing a management system that tracked their budget and accounting procedures proved to be very much of a challenge. So I went there in 1988 to look at how things were going.
Just as a visit, you weren't assigned there.
I was not assigned there. I was asked by Ken Shapiro to go look at the management because we had some concerns. Actually, we had a little bit of problem with some of the resident staff. Corruption is just something you have to deal with. Mm-hmm. So I went there and came back and reported that I thought we ought to have a change of some of the management that we had in place. And that happened.
How long were you over there, Frank?
3 weeks.
And had that been exciting for you to go to Africa?
I was a little apprehensive to go. Uh-huh. But coming out of there, I said, I would really love to get here in a more permanent role. But of course I had my job back here. So Mike McLean, a good friend, was chosen to replace some of the management we had there, and he went there in 1988 on a 2-year leave from his job, an extension. And I went back over there on another short-term assignment during that period to really help advise on implementing a budget and accounting system. I had been doing a little bit of that work here. We talked about this as far as developing our college's information technology. I had made sure I was trained in, at that time, Lotus 1-2-3. Paradox was the database of that era. And so we started working on a system, and I did some of that work on a return trip. Well, when Mike's tour was up, I came into my role in 1981 with the full expectation that nobody should be in the same job for more than 10 years. Uh-huh. And while I was approaching that period, and I really saw this as an opportunity. So I asked to be Mike's replacement, do what he had done, take a leave and go to Africa.
Well, and is this when Roger Weiss has come?
No, Leo was still.
Was still dean.
Yeah, and Leo, and it was a good timing for me because as I reported during that period, our resources had dwindled. The financial situation wasn't all that good. I just felt it was a good time for me to move on.
Was your wife supportive of doing this?
Yes, mainly on the strength of what I reported to her after coming back from my two trips, that this was really would be an opportunity to get away for a while and then reassess where we were going. Well, the project was up for its 5-year review about the time that this was happening. And ironically, USAID is it's an interesting agency because while they're engaged in development of underdeveloped countries, their internal politics, how you get promoted, how you're seen by the higher levels of the agency depends on implementing new programs. Mm-hmm. So one of the weaknesses that I've seen is that our people at the national level that are engaged in this activity just don't hang on to these initiatives long enough for them to become sustainable. Mm-hmm. The roots don't grow deep enough for this to really take hold. Well, USAID, while they were interested in 1985 and during the solicitation of bids, wanted to improve their infrastructure, as it unfolded, they decided it would be better to take more of an extension outreach mission. And they approached CALS to reapply for a continuation grant, but populate our staff with extension agents rather than research. Mm-hmm. And well, I guess our integrity is just too deep because we said, look, UW-Madison is not an extension agency. We have extension faculty, but if it's really outreach you want, we're not really capable of delivering that in a satisfactory way. And if you're going with an outreach mission, you really need to find somebody that's better suited for training extension agents in the field. Mm-hmm. And that's not us. We're research. So USAID said, well, look, okay, if you're not going to go in this direction, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you a 2-year extension, and we'll find somebody else. So your long-term project ends at 7 years rather than 10 or 15 or whatever you thought you were going to get. So Mike was rotating back into his old job, and I approached the college. I said, you know, I would really like to go over and wrap this project up and do my best to implement a budget and accounting system for the Ministry of Finance that is something that we can leave there and walk away and say we've done something. Not that we didn't do things in other places. We did a lot over there, but this was an area that I really thought I was committed to. I had been there to recommend that we go in this direction. Mm-hmm. Mike had been there and was doing great stuff, and it was an opportunity for me to really pick up where he left off and carry it, hopefully, to some conclusion. So my wife and I went to Africa in September of 1990, I think it was.
Are your children all adults
at this
point?
Prior to leaving, we dropped our last daughter off at UW Oshkosh. She was an entering freshman, which really was an interesting thing because she had no support group back here. Her mother and father were in Africa, and she was a brand new freshman with all of probably the anxieties of making this transition with mom and dad gone. Mm-hmm. Happily, she succeeded, and we made it through that period. But we left, and I had already had a double dose of Africa, and the country, its people, its culture. So I knew what I was getting into. And we had people over there, so it wasn't like we were going into the remote part of a Peace Corps environment. We were actually well-treated. And I knew I was going to love it, and I did. So much so, and we made such good progress that when the project ended in 1992, I was asked if I would be interested in coming back. The USAID, they were going through this re-evaluation, and I mentioned they wanted an outreach. Well, by the time our project ended, they abandoned agriculture altogether, they decided that the latest hot topic was the environment and natural resources. So they abandoned their agricultural goals altogether and embarked on a whole new area. So it was about that time that they were implementing the Ag and Natural Resources Project. But the Ministry of Finance had seen what we were doing in agriculture, and they asked me, through funding from the World Bank, to come and work with the ministry and nationalize the whole system that we were doing in agriculture. So it was really an honor.
Yeah, I'll say.
So I came back here for a few months until everything was set. And then I went back and worked with the Ministry of Finance with the goal of nationalizing the budget system that we were implementing for agriculture.
Is Gambia a former British or French colony? Yeah.
Gambia was occupied by the British. It was a British colony. Senegal, which surrounds the Gambia, was a French colony.
Okay.
But the tribal and ethnic groups are all the same. I mean, that part of Africa, you have Jolas, Mandinkas, Wolof, Fula, and maybe a couple even other smaller tribes. So they all speak a common language depending what your tribe is, and even they can cross over. Your Mandinkas can speak a little bit of Wolof can speak a little bit of Mandinka, and then the Fulas are there. They're the cow people. I was asked to come back with the Ministry of Finance. And in the meantime, USAID implemented the Ag and Natural Resources Project. And really, things really went south after that. First of all, when I got to the Ministry of Finance, you have to understand the sort of the development world. There's two different kinds of countries. There's the World Bank countries that have financial assistance that's hired by the World Bank. And then you have the International Monetary Fund that's called the IMF countries, mm-hmm. where their staff is hired by the IMF. Well, the Gambia is an IMF country, but I was working for the World Bank. So guess what? There was already a technician working with the Ministry of Finance from Canada, really. And while he and I had no problem with each other, I was interested in working with him, but he wasn't all that interested in working with me. Mm-hmm. And so the World Bank was trying to negotiate a long-term five-year program with the Gambia, where I would have been a component of this, and it was getting nowhere, mm-hmm. absolutely getting nowhere. And I had signed on for a one-year contract, and my contract was coming up for a renewal. And over on the other side, my work had been replaced by, ironically, a person with my first name, another Frank. And this Frank was not doing well. First of all, he had a bit of an alcoholic problem. He was running a small computer repair and consulting business on the side. Mm. So his home had turned into kind of a computer repair shop. He really wasn't focused on his job. While I tried to engage and collaborate with him, he had no interest in me. I was the guy that he was replacing. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, when my contract was being negotiated or maybe not being negotiated with the Ministry of Finance, USAID fired the other Frank, leaving that position open on the Ag and Natural Resources project. Well, I was already in country. My situation was in limbo. They asked me if I would be interested in working, coming back and working with the USAID. And I jumped at the chance because it was something that I had thought they were going to implement, and I could hand it off to someone and we could work together and I could look at nationalizing it, and none of that worked out. So at least I was getting back to salvage what I could of the system. Mm-hmm. So I basically came home and worked with this new project team, and we were going fine until 1994, when a small group of military officers led a bloodless coup, and all things changed at that point. The day of the coup, the Army, our U.S. Navy, not Army, was in port with one of our ships, and they were they came every 2 years to just make a diplomatic stop. It was a Friday, and this is a Muslim country, so they only worked a half day on Friday because Friday afternoon was prayer afternoon. And in the morning, I had meetings out at the Department of Livestock, and I was on my way out with my driver, and we ran into the Army. And they told me to turn around and go back to the Capitol. They had guns. I said, well, this is strange, because this is not normal. Well, instead of going back to the Capitol, my driver and I drove down into the swamp, and we hid until the Army passed us. They could see us going back, but they didn't see us go off the road, and they went past us, and I got back on the road, and I headed out, and I mean, there were all kinds of strange things going on. I saw military soldiers in vehicles shooting in the air, but I was familiar enough with the countryside that I could avoid the main roads, and we got out, and there was nobody at the livestock office. They had deserted. The Nigerians were the military representatives and consultants to the Gambia army, and they all drove Mercedes. And on my way, I had to pass the airport, and there were these black Mercedes in the ditch with the doors open. Well, that wasn't normal. So I went to my house and called back to the office, and I said, "What's going on?" They said, "Well, there appears to be a military coup in process. Stay where you are." So I stayed in my house and learned later in the afternoon that USDA headquarters was in the Capitol, but the American embassy was in a suburb, and the embassy had negotiated with the young soldiers that had taken over the president's house and the Capitol. They had negotiated safe passage. So all the Americans ended up at the embassy. Oh. And they slept on the floor that whole weekend. And I was in my house. I had videos. I had plenty of food. I was told to stay put. So after a few days, and it was apparent the U.S. Ship had actually taken the president out of the country and took him to Senegal. So really there was a bloodless coup and the soldiers took over. Well, the U.S. government has a policy of not supporting military governments, and so immediately we began to shut down our project. ironically, I ended up being the chief of party. I was the last technician in the country, and I closed the doors and turned out the lights and went to the airport. And so that ended my project. I did a lot of consulting work there, even after we closed the project, because people had money to spend, either from the IMF or the World Bank, and they knew me, and they brought me back on several occasions to work on other projects. So even though the country was now under a military government, I continued to go back and forth on several trips. Very interesting time, but a time where I committed myself to continue international work. In fact, I shared with you when I came back from that, Roger Weiss was the dean, and my position was filled, so I had no place to come back to unless we found other international work. And when I was asked to come back into my old job of associate dean, it was on the condition that I, one, stay for 3 years and not run off to another international long-term assignment. And my condition was that I could continue my international consulting. And to kind of wrap up that whole thing, from really 1996 until, well, recently, as recent as 2004 or 5, I guess, I've had a number of short-term assignments. I've worked in Malawi, Mozambique, Thailand, and Bangladesh. And if there was an opportunity today, I'd take it in a minute.
But Frank, isn't it, are you intrigued to find yourself on a trajectory from Sharon, Wisconsin, to being an international consultant, particularly in Africa?
Yeah. You know, I never dreamed that that would ever happen. From a little farm.
Yeah.
Going to high school in Delavan, which was a major move for a small town boy, and then to the university. I thought those were the largest quantum leaps one could ever make. Mm-hmm. But after getting a taste of many cultures now, I am just amazed at how friendly people are, regardless of their means. You know, if people are fed, they're just an interesting culture to mix with. I loved the African culture. I went there originally with my first wife, and she never made the transition. And that resulted, unfortunately, in a divorce.
Oh.
While I embraced the culture, I went to weddings, I went to baby naming ceremonies. She never felt comfortable with, in that regard, but I worked with these people, and mm-hmm. she didn't.
Yeah.
And so for her to step out of sort of the American community into a more rural environment, that was a tough transition for her to make. But even in Bangladesh, the people are just amazing. Malawi, wherever you go in this world, you meet people that are just so engaging, mm-hmm. So hospitable. It really is fun.
Now, Frank, on these various assignments, has that all been through CALS, or has this been independent consulting that you were sought out?
Always independent. Mm-hmm. Nothing's ever been arranged through CALS. Mm-hmm. So this is just people I met, mm-hmm. contacts I had made, opportunities that kind of presented themselves, and whenever they did, I took advantage of it and went there. A couple trips were CALS related. There was a trip to Mozambique where we had a project and we had some serious administrative issues that I went to investigate. We had a situation in Albania and I stopped there once for 4 days. But those are the only two occasions where it was university related. Most of the time it was just opportunities that presented themselves.
You know, it's so interesting, Frank. There's so much Africa-related work on this campus.
Yeah.
It's very odd, actually. It's important work, but who would have thought that the University of Wisconsin, Madison, would have so many ties to Africa? Jan van Siena in history.
Yeah.
African Languages and Literature was the first such department in a public university.
Well, the college is still engaged in Africa. I mentioned Leo Walsh's commitment to international work, and he hired two faculty members, both of whom still are engaged in international work. They maintain their programs here, but obviously the intention is to stay engaged in the world. Josh Posner was one of those hires, and he's been back to Africa, he's been to South America. Jess Reed in animal sciences is engaged in many parts of the world, I think even Southeast Asia. So we do maintain contacts, but our international area probably isn't as active as it once was. After Leo, our college leadership has focused more on what can we do for Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Part of that, I think, is a result of dwindling resources where, you know, you just have to bite off what you think you can chew, and you better tend the home fires before you start going too far away. Mm-hmm. But I really think that's unfortunate. This college, our university, has had a long history of international work. And we still do. I mean, there's a lot still going on. It's not the long-term kind of stuff. It's more short-term. But it's interesting to see how many people are involved in Africa.
Yeah, I'm constantly amazed. The people who are knowledgeable on the literature, on the history, on the economics. And it's surprising, actually, for a university in Wisconsin. Yeah. You might think it more on one of the coasts. Mm-hmm.
I've never felt threatened in any of these environments. I have to share a story, though, because the day of the military coup, obviously, I came close to encountering the army, but I even then I didn't feel threatened. But after that day, in November of that year, the same year, there was a counter-coup.
Oh.
Now, my house was right next to the public radio station, the national radio station. And at 5 in the morning, I woke up to automatic weapons fire. And I've told you I was a reservist.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew automatic weapon fire. I knew that something was going on. And there was a group that was trying to take over the radio station and declare that they were now in power and throw over this young lieutenant that had taken over. Well, African houses have a wall. Everything is called a compound, not a house. And to partition off your property, the first thing you do if you acquire property is you put up a wall. So all of the compounds are surrounded by walls. So while there was automatic weapon fire right outside my house, I was behind a wall and I was perfectly safe. Mm-hmm. But I didn't even hear weapons fire close to me during the coup. That afternoon and evening, I heard shots, but it was mainly the military that had now declared themselves in power just going around shooting in the air. They weren't killing anyone. Mm-hmm. But here there was some real live engagement. That probably is the closest I've ever felt to being uncomfortable.
Frank, have you followed Gambia?
Oh, yeah.
What is the status of Gambia today?
Bad news. Well, without getting involved in too much of my personal life, when I went back to Africa after separating from my wife mm-hmm. and filing for divorce, I have a new wife, uh-huh. and she's from the Gambia. So we follow the events in Africa all the time. Her parents still live in the Gambia. Uh-huh. And this young lieutenant that came in promising accountability and transparency is still in place today. He came in a young, trim military person. Now he's obese. He's been there for 14 years. Mm-hmm. He's very rich. He's become as corrupt as anyone, more corrupt than the person that he deposed. Mm-hmm. The person he deposed was a very nice gentleman. I'm not saying that maybe there wasn't a little corruption, but he was a man of I wouldn't call modest means, because if you're president, you don't have to live in a modest way.
Right.
But I don't think he was ripping off the country. This guy is literally packing it away for himself, and now refuses to leave. They continue to have elections, but the elections are pretty much bogus. But nobody has the power to overthrow him. In a couple of my return trips, once they were in power, I was working with the National Environment Agency on a short-term consultancy, and my colleague and I went to the Minister of Finance, who was a man of extremely, well, he was educated, he was intelligent, he was also, I think, honest, and while I was there, he was found on a remote roadside near a bridge inside of his burned out car. And it was obviously a staged accident, mm-hmm. but he had been killed. Mm-hmm. He didn't fit in with, he was a little too honest and ethical for, I guess, the regime. But he was taken care of. That's a pretty sad state of affairs.
Do you and your wife go back there to
visit? We've been back. My wife's been back more often than I have. I've been back twice, mm-hmm. Both times on business. Once she went with me. Mm-hmm. And she's been back a couple times. To visit her parents, and her parents have been here. Mm-hmm. They've come here in the last 15 years three times to visit us.
Frank, is Gambia the country that has the fort from which all the slaves were deported?
No.
Which?
That's Senegal.
Oh, and that's Senegal.
Yeah, and what's the name of that island? Most of the slaves were trapped on the Gambia River, and they were transported to Dakar, Senegal. where they were kept on an island in the harbor, a lot like Alcatraz. And now I wish I could remember the name of that island. But they were imprisoned there until they could get on a slave ship and come for...
And that's where President Obama went.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But a lot of the slaves came through the Gambia River for Senegal. Mm-hmm. The Gambia is only about 30 to 40 miles wide and about 300 miles long. And the story is, because there's no border, but the boundary line is kind of, it's not a straight line. And the story is that the boundary of the Gambia was how far the British ships could reach with their guns, or how far they were willing to leave their ships and go inland before they felt they were dangerously too far away. So the country is very narrow and very long. But is all part of that region that provided slaves. And the interesting thing is one tribe would enslave the others. Mm-hmm. The Jolas were always the ones that were the lower class, who ironically the president is a member of the Jola tribe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I became an honorary Fulani. So the person that I employed to take care of my house, I became part of his family. And we had a research station upcountry that I had to visit once a month. And whenever we went upcountry, I'd stay the weekend in his village. And so they would vacate a hut for me whenever I came. So I had my own hut. And I actually became... Because I was there without a wife the second time, mm-hmm. the Peace Corps, I used to host them always on Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Oh.
And then this was my other family, then my African family. So I was part of that group, and now we've lost touch because I haven't been back. But every time I go back, I try to look up my friend Babacar, who was really a close friend.
Frank, there are so many of you, actually, faculty and administrators who have ties to Africa here on campus. Is there any sort of informal group mm-hmm. of you all that you get together?
Well, it's funny you ask. There's the African Association of Madison. The African Association has about 140 paid members. I'm the treasurer, so I'm on the board of directors.
Oh.
By virtue, our bylaws say that you can be a member if you're African or have African ties. So because I was there, and maybe because I have an African wife, I'm mm-hmm. part of that community. I'll just tell you a story. We had a Nigerian man that was killed a couple of weeks ago while coming home from work by a drunk driver at 3:00 in the morning. So he was working the third shift or whatever. And he left a wife and two small boys. I think it was two or three. During his the time of visitation, the story is 5,000 Africans came to visit at that. That tells you the magnitude of the African community in Madison. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure not everyone went. At the funeral alone, I'd say there were 500 to 600.
Really?
Gambians. There's a large Gambian community. some of that is a result of our relationship with the Ministry of Agriculture, because some of these people came here for a degree and they fell in love with Wisconsin, Madison. Mm-hmm. They don't like the weather. But so many immigrate from Africa to New York or Atlanta or the West Coast and find that those cities are not where they want to raise their family. Well, the Gambian community now in Madison, just by word of mouth, has grown to, when they have their summer picnic, they have 300 or 400 at that picnic.
Really?
Yeah. So, yes, there is an organization that tries to provide some services to the larger community. Now, I said we had 120 or more, or maybe 140 paid members. Obviously, the entire community doesn't belong. Mm-hmm. But they use us, and we try to provide a communication system so that people know what's going on.
I'm just curious if you know Daniel Kunene.
Very well. Yeah. Yeah.
He's my neighbor.
Well, and he's a paid member.
So ask him.
Daniel is isn't he a class act?
Yes.
He is really a senior statesman for the African community in Madison.
I did his oral history interview, and I can't recall whether it's restricted or not, but if it's not, you may find it of interest to listen to it, although you may know his whole story.
I don't. I mean, I know him, but, you know, you just don't ask people for their life history.
Well, of course not. You know, I do.
Yeah, you do. That's your job. But when we have an African party, there's an African party 2 or 3 times a month, and the women all cook. When my wife graduated with her BS degree and with her master's degree, we threw a party out in Monona. You would have been amazed at the buffet that was just showed up. And you could start on one end. We had 300 guests. We didn't cater any food. The food was all catered by the African wives and families. And you ask Art, I mean, there was enough food to feed an army. It was unbelievable. Mm. All African dishes. Mm. Yeah.
It's just, it really is so interesting, Frank. It's why I love this job. You never know where people like you
have been
and then where you started from and where you have gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So are you still, you said this, but I'll ask you again. If the opportunity came up again to go to Africa in some capacity, I'm assuming you would.
Yeah. I'm going to Vietnam for 3 weeks in March. I'm going to teach an accounting course there. Ironically, the people that most of these USAID projects are funded through what's called the Beltway Bandits in Washington. They're consulting companies that put together a team of experts and then provide the administrative oversight. And when I was on the Ag and Natural Resources Project, that was through a group in Washington called the International Resources Group. I'm going to visit my daughter in near Washington this weekend.
Oh.
And I'm going to stop in and talk to my friends at IRG. And there's been occasions. Last year they called me up and said, we might have a project in Uganda. Would you be interested? I said, yes. They ended up deciding not to compete for that project. But if something like that came up, I'd take it. At this stage of my life, I would welcome an opportunity to get back into some kind of long-term assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Frank, what do you do with all this knowledge at CALS? Are you sought out at CALS by faculty or others to talk about your work in Africa?
No.
College doesn't take advantage of what you know.
No. Well, the college isn't engaged in what I do. My role in my international work has been with accounting and budgeting and administrative systems.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the college engages in international work, it's to advise on agronomic or environmental research. It's our faculty that are out there bringing to that situation an expertise that they have from all their research. My expertise is out of the School of Business, out of how do you put together an administrative team? How do you build a budget? How do you connect your budget to the accounting system?
Mm-hmm.
Most of what we did in Africa was what I call program-based budgeting, where we linked a budgeting process with certain milestones, certain measurable goals to an accounting system that tracked the cost of delivering that and put in place some kind of process that brought it all together. And that's really what the Ministry of Finance wanted to nationalize,
uh-huh.
is something that was more engaging at the lowest level. Most of their budget is all done at the highest level with major chunks of money. They really didn't get down to a programming aspect where you tried to decide what you wanted to do and how much it was going to cost, and you filed your request with the government and they said, okay, we'll fund that. But then the accounting system had to track the expenditures and track it back to that project. So it was a project budget system. And they tend to do more of a fund budgeting. Here's your salary budget for this agency, lump sum, that's it. They don't allocate it down any lower than that. So what I do is not something any of our faculty would come and seek my advice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But of course you know a lot.
Know a lot.
About Africa. And you probably know a lot of people.
Well, it's surprising how soon those, you've got to keep your contacts. If you don't keep your contacts, and part of my problem was I had a full-time job. Coming back from Africa in 1995 and then accepting technically reinstatement to my old job in 1996, I didn't have a way of really maintaining the kind of contact. And I couldn't afford to go away for more than 3 or 4 weeks at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So I just couldn't come back here for 3 weeks and then jump off to something else for 3 weeks. And the half-life of your relationships can be pretty short.
Mm-hmm.
If I went back to the Gambia now, I only know of, for sure, of one person that's still in his position. Now, I think I probably could find people that have moved around, but I'd have to go back there and find out where they are and what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I've lost touch with most of them. So it's hard to stay engaged.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you ready?
Yeah, so Bob, to kind of conclude the African experience, while I'm very committed to that continent and its people, I'm very discouraged by what's going on there, the corruption, our inability to really do a whole lot. And I don't know what the answer is, but I don't think in my limited exposure to what our government is trying to do there, I just don't see where we have the kind of programs in place that's going to lead to long-term sustainability of what we're doing. Our money is spent, and at the end, I don't see a lot of implementation. The work that I did actually lived for, I'd say, 3 or 4 years beyond my departure. And it died because it was a computer-based system, and computers have a software and a hardware life of, who knows, 12 months, 36 months. And the last time I went there, they were still using the old computers and the latest version of Paradox, which doesn't even exist anymore.
No.
Paradox is gone. So someone had to convert this database from a Paradox software to a Excel or an Access, a Microsoft Access database. It could have been easily done, but the government was not committed to doing it. They ran out of money, and as soon as the money was gone, they never replaced the computers. We implemented a soils testing lab that stayed in engaged for almost 10 years after we left. But when it failed, when the government failed to support it, the soil scientists that we trained became discouraged and actually left and immigrated to the U.S. So he's here now. And the program is a mere shell of what we built it up to be. So the sustainability of anything is really tough. And like I say, I don't have the answer, but I just wish that we would somehow spend our money more wisely.
Frank, you know, I listen to you now, and so I think about Mugabe in Zimbabwe, and I think about the pirates that I think...
Somalia,
and I think of, it wasn't that long ago that there was that horrific Tutus slaughtering.
I forget what the other tribe is, the Tutus and the Hutus?
Yeah. You know, and so many of these things, is Africa itself ungovernable, or is the... Are the nation states that are over there artificial creations resulting from colonization? I don't really know what I'm talking about because I don't know anything about Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious what you see happening over the next century, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's some cause for optimism. While there's always some kind of strife going on, and a lot of competition, tribal competition, and obviously the developing world is coming in, and I think there's some exploitation going on. There's a couple countries that are really democratic. I think there's some hope now that apartheid is kind of ended in South Africa. You know, there's little pockets of optimism. There's other countries that are probably not all that democratic, but are more, but are somewhat democratic, at least not in the throes of a dictator. Where I think there's some progress being made, but for the most part, it's very discouraging because with political upheaval, everything gets turned around. And even in the Gambia, which was a very peaceful country that won its independence and had a long-term president who stayed in power for some reason, and people felt he was getting too old and had to go, and then was replaced by a young lieutenant who's been worse than the one before. There's just so many opportunities like that for corruption, and at the expense of the people. So I don't know. Is there a long-term solution? I think we have to think it's possible. And you just have to keep working at it. Don't know.
How much of an educated class is there in each of those countries?
Education's a big factor in all this. When I was working with the Ministry of Finance, we did a monitoring and evaluation trip, and we toured the country looking at the sort of the education, some of the facilities that had been built, and some that were being proposed. It was just so pathetic. There's a gender disparity, because especially in the countryside and with some of the tribes that really were my people, the Fulanis, the young girls are not educated beyond fourth or fifth grade. In many cases, they're betrothed by age 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. The daughters provide no value to the family except that they are, through arranged marriages, they provide some income because the marrying family, there's a tradition that they come with cows or with some sort of a dowry. And so there's incentive for the young girls to be really married at a very early age, because why keep them around to feed them? There's no incentive to educate them whatsoever. So especially in the provinces, only the males are educated. That's different in the urban areas. My current wife, grew up in the urban area. She gets very disgusted with me when I start talking about the parts of Africa that she said, you're just promoting the stereotype image of Africa, the mud huts, the people running around, not doing much farming. And she said, that's not how I grew up in Africa. And she's right. If you go to Dakar, Senegal, or Banjul, the Gambia, or some of the other metropolitan areas of Africa, it's very westernized. The education system is very equal. The females are educated all the way through high school. But if you get into provinces, that's not the case. And so there's an educational goal that needs to be met somewhere down the line.
Are there still a lot of Africans coming to universities in this country?
Oh, yeah.
To get advanced degrees?
Yeah, and a lot of the African community of Madison came here and never really left. Now, that's not as easy after 9/11 as it was prior to 9/11. Mm-hmm. But the African community in Madison is well educated and hold very nice positions.
And would rather stay here.
And would rather stay here, yeah. We had some good friends from Sierra Leone that these are people that save money that want to go home. My wife wants to go home. Actually, I wouldn't mind going home. Mm-hmm. The Gambia, at least the capital city, is on the coast of West Africa. It's a San Diego climate. You're right on the beach. There's lovely restaurants. There's a couple golf courses.
What's the name of the city?
Banjul.
I'm so ignorant, yeah. As I suppose most Americans are.
Yeah. So this young couple, they had saved a lot of money. plus they owned a house. And they were going to go back to Sierra Leone and build a house and open a business. And they were both educated. She was a nurse. He was a school teacher. And there was a civil war. And their family lost everything. And they said, why do we go back? Why do we leave what we have here? Their hearts are still in Africa, but for the sake of their family and their kids and the education and the opportunities they have here, they stay. Yeah.
Got a shift now. Frank, I want to ask you now to shift your attention from Africa back, focused on the university. And we had talked last time off record about your involvement with the governance of academic staff and its role on campus, and would like to have you give us a little background on that and talk about your role.
Yes, so I've had a long association with what I'm going to call shared governance. Obviously, I started here many years ago, and the faculty governance culture on this campus has always been very strong. Maybe I got involved because of my role in the college and its bridge from really our academic programs to the campus programs. And much of my work in the research area was in business oriented, in budgeting and accounting and this sort of thing. So I got to know some of the key staff in other colleges and in other areas of what I call campus administration.
Can you name some of those people?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Marita Weiss, Dorothy Kleinfelter, Carla Rotz, Bob Dye in engineering, Don Miner. Those are a lot of the names that at one point we were all what I'd call junior administrators in our respective units. And this is a group, all the people I mentioned, decided one day, why I can't remember, we decided, you know, we ought to get together and just share stories, network, you know, what are you working on, what are you dealing with, and we really shouldn't take work time. What we need to do is we started meeting at Gino's on State Street.
Oh, yeah?
Upstairs.
Uh-huh.
And it was after work.
This in the early 80s, perhaps?
Yeah. Oh, it dates back before that. It was probably in the mid-70s.
Okay.
Yeah. Or maybe even early 70s. And we were all basically young kids almost. And we called ourselves the Concerned Administrative Group. And that group still lives on campus. It's called the CAG Group. Now, because of my work and my transition to other things, I've turned that over to Paul Jelly in our operation, so he meets with that group. And I think now they're just deciding that there's no use for that anymore. It's probably time to disband it. But it got to the point where we matured and we started actually meeting not in a bar, but we met at each other's house.
Oh.
And then it turned into kind of a professional development opportunity where we would invite speakers in to talk to us. And then it matured to the point where campus realized that we were a very important group to use as a sounding board for systems development or whatever.
Oh.
And so I got involved in, you know, affairs outside the college. And it was about, you know, this time in the mid-70s where because I think there was some pressure towards unionization and collective bargaining, that the campus decided there really ought to be a governance structure that provided the academic staff with a voice. We had all kinds of academic staff in our research and teaching programs and our administrative areas, and that we ought to have something. Well, then there was the Hayes Hill titling exercise that came along that actually pigeonholed all of us and set up a salary structure. And I'm not sure how all of this fits together time-wise.
But and what is Hayes Hill?
Hayes Hill was an attempt to place an administrative structure on the academic staff.
The entire academic staff?
The entire academic staff. You know, my memory's growing weak, and I can't remember who chaired that, but a lot of us participated in that as well. And we developed position descriptions, title series, category A and category B, academic staff. And it was about the same time where the campus said, well, we really ought to have rules. And it predates Hayes Hill, because Hayes Hill came after this. We needed some policies and procedures to govern this group of employees that really had become an important part of this university. So I don't remember how I got involved. Because of my connections and networking, I was asked to serve on a committee that was chaired by Tom Hoover to draft the first academic staff policies and procedures. And we met for well over a year and wrote and drafted and debated and finally came up with a document that we presented to the chancellor.
Who was chancellor then, Shane?
I think it was Shane. I'm pretty sure it was Shane at that time. I'm trying to remember who all was on the committee, but just as recent as a couple of years ago, in talking to Colleen Hayes, who was the secretary of the academic staff, we went back in the records, and there was a document that detailed who was on that committee, and all those names came back, and I probably lost them. But Rita Weiss was one of them. Phil Helmuth.
Oh.
Phil was on that committee. Dorothy Kleinfelter, I think, was on that group, and several others. And we drafted that first language. And the first group was called the Academic Staff Committee. And we had to run for an appointment, and I decided to run for that first committee, and I was elected to the committee. And I think I served two terms. And it was about that time that I was starting to move up in the college and decided that I really had to focus my attention in other areas. But I was part of that early work. And then when I went off to Africa, they kind of rewrote those rules and they developed the Academic Staff Assembly, modeling staff governance to parallel the faculty governance with the faculty senate. And so when I came back in my role, I got re-involved in academic staff governance and became an assembly person for a couple years, and then ran and was elected to the executive committee. So I served on the academic staff executive committee for, I think, a total of a little over 4 years, maybe 4.5, 5 years. And for 1 year, I was the chair of that committee.
And what are the issues that you're dealing with?
One of the issues, that we, ironically, you know how things come around. While I was chair, Another issue was the whole issue of whether or not we should opt for collective bargaining. And so something that was the impetus for even organizing staff in the beginning, of course, never went away. Mm-hmm. And I think collective bargaining is going to continue to come up over and over and over again.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I couldn't guess what's going to happen, but I always objected to how the process worked, because if you vote to, first of all, you don't vote for collective bargaining. You vote for enabling legislation. Mm-hmm. So you're voting to enable, which doesn't mean you get it. It only means that you have an opportunity to vote whether you actually get it or not. Well, my experience, I was always closely aligned to management, so I always felt that we were better off being closely aligned with the faculty. And as long as the faculty were organized or unionized, why in the world would we want to unionize ourselves? We're only going to create another problem. Of course, that attitude isn't shared by everyone. There's a lot of people that value unionization, opportunities that allows. And so my big problem was, well, if we vote to have a vote on unionization, and typically only 30 or 40% of the staff come out to vote, you know, your future is being decided by a minority. And I just didn't like that. So I personally never favored it. But that continues to be an issue. I think the whole culture on this campus, the terminology in my time here has shifted from faculty governance to shared governance. The vocabulary you hear now, I rarely hear faculty governance mentioned unless it's dealing with a faculty issue, and that faculty governance is the has jurisdiction over this. But when you talk of governance in general, I always hear it referred to as shared governance. And I think that's a monumental step forward. Maybe it's not far enough or fast enough for a lot of people, but it's brought us a long way. Within colleges, you have committees on academic staff issues. So you have a governance process, even at the division and college level, that we never had before. I sense there's a real degree of representation by academic staff on a lot of committees that we may have been recognized or represented before, but never in our role as being a staff member, always because we had a certain expertise that brought value to that committee. Now I think you see academic staff being appointed to committees representing academic staff and their voice that should be heard in a lot of these issues.
Well, and this is germane because once we put you to work with Elaine Klein identifying subjects for oral history interview, what my hope is that you will help us expand the pool beyond faculty that need to be interviewed.
Yeah. So really, I'm quite proud of the fact that I was there on day one. that I was asked to help Tom and that early committee fabricate.
And for the record, Tom was registrar.
He was registrar at that time. I think it would be fun. I wish I could document in this interview the members of that committee. I know you've interviewed Tom.
I did.
So it's possible that he identified the committee in his interview. I don't know.
I don't remember.
Yeah, but I think it's so important to keep a lot of that history. I do remember the first chair of that committee was not Tom Hoover. When the academic staff committee was formed, Alistair McCormick was the first chair of the committee. I can't even remember if Tom stayed on the committee. I think he decided to step down, but I'm not sure of that. So it's been fun. I really like the new system. I enjoyed being an assembly person. I enjoyed being part of the academic staff executive committee and the types of work that they do. I was the chair designee for the college's CASI. And so I've worked at the college level on staff involvement. And I think that's one of the, I mean, we talked earlier about what changes have occurred, and I talked more about the allegiance that the faculty have to their research.
Yes.
And not the kind of collegiality or camaraderie you might have seen in the past at the college and department level. But another big change has been the whole involvement of staff. I mean, in round numbers, there's 2,000 faculty and 6,000 academic staff. And if you start to count the staff that are loosely connected, clinical faculty and some of those part-time, you can get close to 77,000 and above. This is a group of people that do a lot for the university. What I've seen in our college, as the faculty have become entrepreneurial, as they've been torn away from the bench type work that they used to do, and they've had to hand that over to staff, there's a training component with graduate students. But there's a very important middle group that provide the sustainability and the of their programs. And PIs have become personnel managers and business managers more so than they were in the past. It used to be the PI and their students. Now there's a middle group that are carrying out a lot of the scientific work in a team environment. And the faculty have become more and more managers than maybe the scientific work that they've done in the past. And it's academic staff that have provided that, even in the classroom. As faculty have been asked to do more and more, and we have less faculty than we had before, we've had to hand over some of the entry-level teaching duties to instructors and teaching staff, not faculty. And these are people that have dedicated their life to a teaching role rather than a science role. And we have some of the best in Cal's that teach beginning bacteriology, beginning biochemistry, some of these things.
Frank, one of the issues that I hear, now this is from faculty who are the primary people I talk to, is generally a sense of great unhappiness that Bascom is now running the university and the faculty senate and faculty governance counts for much less. Do you share that perspective from a shared government perspective?
Well, yes and no. And I'll tell you why I have to say yes and no. In terms of staff governance, we're infants compared to the faculty. Faculty governance has played such a prominent role in the past that it's ingrained. And there's many of the faculty have, I think, sense a loss of position as time has gone on, and at the centralized executive group has played a more of a role. And I think that evolution is kind of natural. I think outside University of Wisconsin, I doubt you'd ever find the kind of faculty governance that existed here. We still preach of that. Mm-hmm. We still, and I think evidence of that occurred just recently with the vote of the Faculty Senate on the whole reorganization of the graduate school.
Yeah, unanimous, I heard.
Well, there was apparently one dissenter.
Oh.
But they said, hey, we're not going to stand for this any longer, and there comes a time where we have to put our foot down. On the staff side, you know, if you look at how long have we been around, 150 years, or we had the sesquicentennial years ago.
1848.
170 years. And wherever the faculty governance was born in that process, it had to be way back. Mm-hmm. Well, staff governance dates back to probably the late 70s. And even then, we were a committee of nine. Mm-hmm. We didn't turn into an assembly or an executive group probably until, I think it happened really in the late 80s and going into the, while I was maybe thinking of going off to Africa. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's the same sense on the academic staff side because we didn't know what it was like before.
Uh-huh.
We're just happy that we have a voice now.
Yeah, so you're really on the upswing.
We're on the upswing. And I think we appreciate so much being heard that we still think that, you know, there's more governance to be had. So we're not losing, we're gaining. We're making inroads into the governance process that we've never had before. CASI is an example, where now every college has a CASI. Well, we never had that before. So for us to say we're losing, I think is impossible to say. Mm-hmm. We still think we're gaining.
Frank, was Joanne Elder a key person in this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, Joanne was on that early committee, yeah. I'm sorry I didn't mention her name before. Joanne was an advocate for organization.
I asked because I interviewed Joe Elder,
yeah,
and he said that I ought to interview Joanne.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would say she would be a key component. She was there in those early days. She was a student advisor in sociology, but she was very engaged in the early organization of staff. My guess, I don't know, she would have to say this. I'm not sure whether she would ever say she was in favor of unionization, but she was certainly in favor of organization and fought diligently for that. She would be a good, she was on that, the drafting committee, and I'm pretty sure she was on the first committee. Yeah.
What do you see coming down the pike, you know, say for the next couple of decades for academic staff?
Boy, that's, we had some budget reductions a couple years ago now where, I'm just speaking about CALS now, mm-hmm. and I'm using this experience to maybe answer your question. We had to give up 35 FTEs in the college, and 24 of those 35 were staff.
Hmm.
And we pretty much did that by either attrition or in some cases moving staff that were on state funds over to soft funding.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have any layoffs per se. Now we're going through another budget cut. And if you look at the long-term budget prognosis, while maybe this state is better off than most as it thinks about higher education or education in general, it's clear over the past several years, maybe decade or two, that the state obligation to the penal system, to welfare, to a lot of other programs is kind of pushing higher education down the totem pole. Maybe we are our own worst enemy in that case because of our success with grant funding and other sources of revenue, because obviously, hey, you can't expect a welfare program to go out and, unless you tap into the federal government for money, you've got to cover it somehow out of state tax resources. So what's the long-term budget future? We're going to continue to be hard-pressed budgetarily. We're never going to climb out of that. I think it's going to force us to look at how we fund the university. And while we went through this period of growth, I never knew the number of academic staff that may have been here when I first started, but I'm going to take a rough guess that where now the faculty to staff ratio is 1-3, mm-hmm. my guess is it, you know, in the early days of my career, it was 1-1 at mm-hmm. best, maybe 1-2 or somewhere between. But there's going to be more pressure to do things, to do more or as much with less. Mm-hmm. As that starts to weigh more heavily on staff, I think you're going to see, because we now talk to each other, because there's a governance process that can start to raise the question, well, how many staff did we lose as a result of this? Mm-hmm. At some point, the scale is going to tip, and we're going to have some kind of decision on enabling legislation. And depending on how the climate is at that time, I could see a bargaining situation evolve.
Uh-huh.
And
interesting.
I don't know if that'll ever happen, but I think we're moving closer to that possibility.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
I think the staff could unionize before the faculty. I don't have numbers on the organization that, what is it? Oh, I forget the name of the group now, but there's a group that's promoted collective bargaining for a long time.
Yes.
The faculty union, is it? Faculty and staff union?
No, it's... Yeah. Is it profs?
Well, profs and ASPRL are two different. They're similar. Profs is where the faculty contributes some of their money to a lobbyist.
A lobbyist downtown.
And on our side, it's ASPRL. We hire a lobbyist to represent academic staff issues.
Oh.
But there's also this organization that likes to promote unionization.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, and where I was going is, I don't have numbers on those people, on their membership, but I would suspect that if someone wanted to track that, you'd see that more and more of their members are coming from the staff side. Mm-hmm. And while maybe the faculty numbers, if it's growing, it's flatter. And that trend line maybe should tell us something.
Frank, this is sort of a segue away, but not completely. Just yesterday and today, the news media, radio and newspaper, have been full of this new report from Pew polling organization that Wisconsin and eight other states are in the same shape as California.
Yeah.
That quite serious shape. And severe cuts are looming.
Right.
And if that's true, and I have no reason to doubt Pew, they're pretty reputable, that's going to hit the university pretty hard, isn't it?
It has to. Because if you put yourself in a political situation and you have all these other services that you've got to fund, and you've got an entity like ours that continues to be pretty successful with other sources of revenue, and the teaching side, I mean, I guess we can always raise tuition. That's going to be a hard thing to balance. Even within the UW system itself, if you look at the other campuses who really don't have the same kind of opportunity that Madison has, I mean, we get a revenue stream from indirect costs associated with federal grants that doesn't exist at, well, the closest one would be Milwaukee. Well, allocating resources within the UW system is going to be tough. Can you imagine being the university president and having to deal with a state-mandated cut for higher education? And then how do you treat Madison relative to others? At what point are we going to have to close one of those campuses? Or is that ever going to be a possibility? We can't hardly close anything now. Everything is so regionalized. And each little campus has its legislative group, that the only way that we can do it is to maintain the entire system.
Frank, I have had in this past year, probably a half a dozen very thoughtful faculty members say that it is very clear that the UW-Madison, probably in a decade or two, will no longer be in the first rank. It will be one of the better second-tier public universities. What's your reaction to that? Do you think that's likely?
It's more likely than we'll hold what we have. I'm not sure we'll fall to the second tier. I'm going to tell you why. First of all, unlike anywhere else, we have Wharf. Wharf has the capability of sustaining us beyond maybe some others. Second, we have one of the most productive faculties going. I mean, why is it that in this competitive world we continue to build a research protocol, a research portfolio, rather, that continues to grow in spite of a declining number of faculty? Our grant getting success continues to be strong. Our intellectual property rights continues to grow. Another factor of Wharf being there to support intellectual property and how that money flows back. Finally, at the end of the day, I really have to question why are we even here? How did a university like this happen in the state of Wisconsin over the years? How did we happen?
Yeah, how did we?
We happened because we had some key leaders that put things in place. Maybe they didn't even know what they were doing, but We understood the value of education. We had faculty that understood that their discoveries could reinvest in the institution they loved to provide the capitalizing on intellectual property. And at the end of the day, I think our state has been so committed to higher education that in the end we won't lose it. Now, that's a pretty optimistic stand in the face of the budget and in the face of a UW system that puts us in competition with, 11 other campuses. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm an optimist, and the pessimist would say we're heading for the second tier and lower. I think it's going to be tough. We're not going to be the number three or four or the number one. I mean, if public institutions, I think we're still number one in certain areas. But I don't think we're going to free fall out of this status. I don't think the state will let us. I think some of how we're put together and packaged is going to give us, will insulate us against this, as opposed to maybe some of our peers. Anyway.
Interesting.
That's my point of view.
Yeah, well, that's what this is.
Yeah. Yeah.
This now concludes the November 12, 2009 session with Associate Dean Frank Kustra.